From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, January the 7th, 2020, and I haven't said 2019 yet for almost an entire week now, so I've been worried about this. You know, most people do that on a check at least once or twice in January. They write the previous year's date, and so far, and you know, my thing here is I got to not only write checks but occasionally, but I have to say the date on the radio, and I keep wondering when I'm going to announce that it's some previous year, but we're not going to go there if we can avoid it, because 2019... I'd just as soon leave in the history books and move on and into the future here, folks. So, we have a good show lined up for you this morning. My first guest this morning is Josh O'Gorman. He's a reporter for the Stowe Reporter, has also reported for the Waterbury Record, the Times Argus, and Rutland Herald. Previous to that, he was a fixture at the State House for a few years over there when my last few years as I covered the for the Associated Press, the Vermont Legislature, which, by the way, is getting underway, resuming their 2019-2020 biennium this very morning. I'm going to be over at the State House on Friday morning. We're going to start our weekly trips to Montpelier to get some news from under the Golden Dome and interview lawmakers about what they have on their agendas and so on and so forth. Those Friday morning sessions at the State House will start on the 10th, just 3 or 4 days from now. So we'll and that's always a lot of fun for me. I like to go back down to the State House and visit. And once a week is about a good enough dose for me. I don't have to go there every day as I used to. So that's a nice life balance and so on. So that's good. Anyway, as I mentioned, and I should tell you later on in the show, we have an excellent pair of interviews lined up. At least I hope they will be. They're going to be interesting. I know that. And that is big news this weekend from the Brattleboro Retreat. That is the state's most busy, significant mental health facility these days. Of course, when Tropical Storm Irene flooded Waterbury back in 2011, the old Vermont State Hospital was closed, and that sent the state mental health system into some significant turmoil for a number of years. And the Brattleboro Retreat has been a linchpin in holding that system together ever since. And the Brattleboro Retreat has been in some financial straits recently, and they announced, told the state last week that we need another $2 million cash infusion, or we're going to have to put it on the block or maybe close. And boy, that would be a kind of a scenario, maybe a nightmare scenario for the state's mental health system. And anyway, the state's pushing back hard and saying, we've given you enough money recently, and you just got to figure out how to keep your books a little better. Well, we're going to get both sides of that story in the second hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM today. Louis Josephson, the CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat, will be joining us. And actually, prior to him, Sarah Squire, the Commissioner of Mental Health, will be stopping by the studio here. So got a couple of two interviews lined up to work through these issues relating to the Brattleboro Retreat and the state's mental health system in the second hour. But first, we are going to get the sanest guy in Vermont on the air here.
Oh, my goodness.
That is Josh O'Gorman. Good morning, Josh. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, Dave. Thank you for having me. It's great.
And Josh, tell me a little bit about the dealings going on in the Harwood Union School District. Is really been roiled recently by a lot of discussion about a potential school closure, and we are in the throes of trying to write a new budget for the school district, I'm told. And so give us an update. What's going on down there?
Well, it's interesting. We're kind of starting the year in some way in a similar place there where we were at last year, in that the board is grappling with a couple of questions. And the first is what to do with the 7th and 8th graders that are currently at Harwood. There has been a voluntary migration of students from Harwood Middle School to Crossetbrook Middle School in recent years. These students are exploring intra-district choice, in which they can choose to go to a school school other than where they would normally go based on their geography, as long as the school has capacity for them and they don't have to hire any new staff. And so an increasing number of parents have been taking advantage of this to the point where some people question whether or not it's still sustainable to continue to offer middle school at Harwood, or if all, pardon me, yeah, it, whether it's sustainable to keep the 7th and 8th graders there, or whether they should all go over to Crossett Brook. And so a year ago, they were questioning, you know, what to do about this. And they were paralyzed with this question of how do you make this decision in a vacuum outside of a larger district-wide vision. And they felt that they needed to come up with a plan that's going to go ahead and guide them for the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years potentially. And so they went ahead and over the course of last year went ahead and developed this plan that they adopted on November 13th of this year. It was a long process. They looked at like 30 different options and eventually winnowed it down to the option that they adopted, which is going to call for the closure of Faceton Elementary School. It's going to move 7th and 8th graders over to Crossett Brook, and it's going to cease education of 5th and 6th graders at Moortown. They would be going to Crossett Brook or to a school of their choice by exploring choice. And so with this plan in place, they're now able to tackle this question of 7th and 8th graders, and they're also able to tackle this question they've been looking at since before the school district came into existence, and that is a bond that they really need to make significant improvements to the Harwood School itself, which was built back in the 60s with all the union schools and needs a lot of significant upgrades. And so the board is grappling with those same questions, but now they have greater guidance based on the plan that they've created. But while they're doing this at the same time, they're also doing what all school districts are doing, which is crafting their budget for the season. So they have a lot going on.
And the I'm wondering, you mentioned this sort of near the top of your last set of remarks that there's been, I don't know if you call it natural migration, was that the phrase?
Sure.
From the Harwood 7th and 8th grade classes over to Crossett Brook by virtue of school choice. Kids are, and their families are just saying, rather go to Crossett Brook. What's up with that? Why is that happening?
Well, it's a newer facility for sure. It's my understanding that there are some differences in the course offerings from between Harwood and Crossett Brook. I think you can get more of a science tech education at Crossett Brook, as I understand it. And I think their music program, I think, is a little bit more expansive, as I understand it. There's just been people, I guess, would prefer to go to the newer school, I think. And, you know, a lot of these decisions are also just based on geography. You know, where the heck are the parents commuting? A lot of decisions are made just simply based on, you know, what's the best route during the day back and forth to home, and what school is going to be most convenient. So it's a combination of factors for sure what's driving this my migration of students from Harwood to Crossett Brook, but it's certainly happening.
And
it's not going the other way, I suppose I should also
Yeah,
say.
That's it. What's the typical commute that results in Crossett Brook being an easier drop-off than Harwood? Any idea?
Darned if I know off the top of my head, Dave. Okay. I don't know.
You're not following the local traffic patterns in any great detail, I'm guessing.
No.
That's interesting. But, you know, in the longer term and the bigger picture here about the Harwood Union School District, and I should say, by the way, as sort of controversial and roiled as things have been in the member towns of the district, which, of course, extends from Waterbury down the Med River Valley all the way to Warren, Harwood Union School District, I've got some admiration, really, for the folks who live there and are involved. They are really involved, and they are taking this whole participatory democracy thing very seriously. And, you know, hats off, because I know not everybody's in agreement about what the proper way forward is. There's whenever, you know, I've had a couple shows now devoted purely. I had one show that I think was the only time I've done this in my almost 2 years on the radio here, and that was a 2-hour program devoted to one topic.
Oh yeah.
Which was the future of the Harwood Union School District. Mm-hmm. And boy, did we have we had lots of participation. And by the way, 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. If you folks out there would like to weigh in and give us a little update on what you're thinking about the future of the Heartwood District, while Josh O'Gorman of the Story Reporter Waterbury Record is here talking about the that very topic, this is the time, 244-1777. What are you hearing? What are you seeing? What are you feeling down there in the Heartwood? I keep saying down there because I sort of picture the Mad River Valley, but it involves right here. We are smack dab in the Heartwood Union District here in Waterbury at the WDEV studio, and so Waterbury folks are welcome to call also. 244-1777 is a call-in number, and we'd be curious to know just what the current thinking is. Now, there was the vote on November 13th. Give us a recap. What happened there, Josh?
Well, by the time we got to that second week in November, the board had been winnowing down these plans that they initially created, approximately 30 plans they came up with in, I think, May. And so then after taking their break over the summer, they came back in September and they began winnowing down those plans one by one. And some of them they were able to dismiss easier than others. I mean, so one of the plans involved, I think, closing all the schools and just tuitioning. So they were able to dismiss a number of them really, really quickly. But eventually they started grappling with some really tough decisions about if they're going to close a school in the Valley or not close a school in the Valley, and if they're going to close a school in the Valley, which one would it be? And it definitely, you were right. It definitely, there's an impassioned electorate down there, Valley, who came out for this series of hearings that the board held. And absolutely, people made their voices heard for sure, that they didn't want to see anything closed, that they wanted to maintain the status quo. But at the same time, there were a handful of folks who were coming from the Waterbury area who were saying, hey, it's time for you guys to make a decision here. And go ahead and make some sort of change. You make some sort of long-term plan and make that hard decision for sure. So that's kind of what the back and forth was this past fall over the decision.
Now, does this set up a bond issue for town meeting day?
Initially, the plan was for them to create their master plan and then with that, use that as guidance for the bond request that they were going to put out. And the initial plan back in May was that they were going to have bond vote this coming town meeting in March. They're going to be voting tomorrow night. I can't see the future, but from what's on the agenda, it looks like they're going to vote to push that out to June 9th to actually have their bond proposal, which kind of makes sense. I think they need to spend a little more time probably crafting what it's going to be because, I mean, those warrants need to be signed by the end of January here because town meeting comes really, really early this year, as I recall. Like, it's, what is it, the second or something?
Yeah, I don't remember the date exactly, but of course, it's always the first Tuesday in March. And mm-hmm. So that is coming right up, and a lot of local municipal elections are getting ready to close nomination periods and get your petitions in, folks, if you want to run for your local boards and city councils and all that good stuff, because it's that time of year. And people are out already campaigning and so on. I see evidence of that in Montpelier where people are making their announcements. I'm running for city council and so on and so forth. And so, hey, speaking of the city of Montpelier, John Odom's going to be my guest tomorrow. He's the city clerk there, and he's got some interesting information he's going to share with us about using blockchain technology to strengthen voting security. And so we're going to hear John's a real he's becoming a nationally regarded expert on voting security and cybersecurity around elections, and he actually has been to some conventions where people go out of their way to try to break into election systems and this sort of ethical hacking stuff to test systems and make sure that they can resist any getting messed around with by foreign actors or really any actors who are trying to alter the democratic process here via computer technology and so on. So I think that'll be an interesting conversation right off the first top of the show tomorrow with John Odom, the Montpelier City Clerk. But Josh, I wanted to, while I have you here, you've been covering another interesting issue here in Vermont recently, and that is the impact of these Juul e-cigarettes on our younger population in the state in particular. There's a lot of concern out there about young people taking up smoking e-cigarettes, and some from Vermont school districts are suing this manufacturer called Juul, which I guess is the top maker of these e-cigarettes in the country, right?
Yeah, they're among the cheapest, and so they're going to be the most popular with people with limited discretionary income, such as kids.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, this lawsuit, I don't know if it was started, but I know one of the big heavy hitters in terms of plaintiffs are the L.A. Unified School District, which has 735,000 students in it, so more than the entire population of Vermont. And basically, they are suing, saying that, you know, this thing is an absolute epidemic. It's bad for kids' health. It's bad for everything all around. I can tell you anecdotally, I have a good friend who teaches at one of our local high schools in the area that's going to rename nameless. And it's just an epidemic there. Like every time you turn around, there's some kid sucking on a Juul. So on January 2nd, the Trump administration issued guidelines that outlaws most of the flavors. They outlaw what they call fruit, dessert, and mint. Those are the three categories that they outlaw. So everything from bubblegum to mango, all these like exotic flavors, or maybe not so exotic flavors. They've banned everything except for menthol flavor and tobacco flavor. And so here in Vermont, a number of school districts have already signed on with this lawsuit, including some of the larger ones in the state, including Burlington and Barry and Rutland. Montpelier signed on as well. And so tomorrow night at the Harwood School Board meeting, they're going to hold a vote on this, where it's likely they're going to go ahead and join this lawsuit, I would imagine.
And is this sort of a class action suit, or how's that working? Do you know?
That's what I understand. No specified damages at this time, as I understand it. But it doesn't cost the school district anything to sign on to it. It's on contingency.
Okay, but I guess my question then is, what are they seeking?
Eventually, they're going to be seeking damages, I imagine. They're going to be seeking some sort of financial compensation.
And based on, I mean, is this a theory that, let me cut to the chase here. What is the cost to the school districts that is being claimed?
I think just they're going to be talking about the direct health impacts to the students, for sure. There's also arguments to be made that it's taking away from the learning experience if you're constantly ducking out and smoking.
Well, there is that. I don't. And sometimes, you know, lawsuits will seek not just monetary damages, but injunctive relief, where they're basically saying, and it sounds to me like that may be more the ticket here. I don't know. This is all total speculation on my part. And if anybody is involved in this lawsuit out there and actually knows its contents, I haven't seen it yet. But I'm just trying to think through what the issues are that a school district would sue an electronic cigarette manufacturer. What would be the basis of that lawsuit? The claims might include, as you said, Josh, that it's disruptive to the educational process because kids are ducking out all the time to smoke or to vape, I guess, and so there's that issue. But again, I don't really see whether that's a monetary cost to the school district. Maybe there's some way that they have of calculating what that monetary cost might be, but I guess I'm initially a little skeptical there. But there is a sort of a bandwagon going on here right now, and it's understandable because a lot of people are concerned about tobacco, basically nicotine. These things are not good for you, whether they are consumed via a cigarette, a pipe, a vaping device like this Juul electronic cigarette deal. None of that stuff is good for you, and so I'm not advocating for them at all. I'm just trying to figure out. I think sometimes people go to court and file lawsuits that are tangential. Let's put it that way. If you get my drift, Josh, I don't know.
There's certainly a long history of states suing tobacco companies and getting settlements that they then use for other purposes in their general fund budgets.
Yeah, and I sort of get the nexus there because the states are saying, look, you know, especially in Medicaid or in any of the sort of other health programs where even the public employee health program, the health coverage, our costs are going up like crazy. And one of the drivers of those costs is people coming down with various smoking-related, traditionally it was smoking, related illnesses. Yeah, okay, all that makes sense. So you could actually do a study and come up with a rough number to say, you know, Vermont's state employee health insurance plan and health coverage plans went up by, let's say 10% over a period of a couple of years, and some percentage of that increase is attributable to people getting sick from smoking. Okay, now I'm starting to get it in terms of like there's actual real money being spent here. It's costing us. We're going to turn around and sue you to recover those costs. All that kind of fits together. I'm just trying to understand what the puzzle pieces are. Similarly, when a school district says, I've got teenagers here who are sneaking out of class to go vape, and the cost of us as a school district is X, and here's what supports that. You know, that's the sort of thing I'm curious about. And so if anybody out there has an idea how that works, I think, would you agree, Josh, that you're as stumped as I am on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So yes. The two guys in the booth here are stumped. I don't know if anybody out there has a thought about whether how that works. You know, what is the what's the crux here? That but again, you know, lawyers famously tell me over the years, all my work as a reporter, I talked to a lot of lawyers, and I used to hear this line all the time: anybody can sue anybody over anything. So, you know, how far it gets in court is another question. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Mary in Randolph. Good morning, Mary.
Hi. Good morning.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I'm amazed that they allow these vaping pens or vaping cigarettes, whatever they're called, even in the school. Why are they not subject to confiscation? I guess I'm old school. I mean, we weren't even allowed to chew gum in school.
Yeah, remember those days? No chewing gum in school?
Yeah.
Wow.
I graduated in 1972, so now I'm old school, but I don't know why they'd even allow to have them in school and why they wouldn't be confiscated and then returned on their way out the door. And even cell phones. I think kids are on cell phones all day in school, which I don't get.
That is another big issue that is you hear about from schools all the time now. And again, for those of us who graduated before cell phones were a thing, it sounds kind of unimaginable. But who knows? You know, the world changes over time. And let me ask you though. You said Mary that your suggestion would be to take away the vaping device, return it at the end of the day.
Confiscate it. And on the way out the door, when you're going home, then you can do what you want to do.
Yeah.
On the school property. It's public property, but...
My one other worry here is that the kid shows up with a you know, these things are small. They're like pencil size, right,
Josh?
Yeah,
they're tiny.
Yeah. So, I mean, it would be just in your pencil case, in your backpack or something. And you know, without searching kids as they come into the school, which I find to be a little bit hard to imagine... Yeah. Both from a civil liberties point of view and just from the practical point of view, now you got 300 kids lined up at the school door at 8:30 in the morning, and I got to go through all their backpacks. So I'm going to get classes started at 11. I don't know. That's a tough one, but I get your sentiment, Mary. Definitely, I think you're onto something there.
Yeah. All right. When they're standing outside the classroom, though, take that. You know, they've got to be watched.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. I mean, kids are, if they're seen on school grounds vaping, then that's another point of possible intervention. So there you go. Yeah. Mary, thank you so much for the call. Let's hear from you more frequently in 2020. Love to hear from you. All righty. Hey, let's go to Guy in Berlin. Good morning, Guy.
Hi. Yeah, those things are like thumb drives, and they're the security, and to actually get kids to voluntarily give them up. They're having a hard time with cell phones in school districts across Vermont. Just saying no cell phones. So these things, you know, that's going to be really hard. Josh made a point about the settlement money. Actually, you know, Vermont did get a lot of settlement money, and they did use it for a long time. They really put it into tobacco control, which is one of the reasons why youth smoking has gone way down in Vermont. It's a fact. Marijuana smoking has gone way up. But youth smoking, nicotine, tobacco has gone way down. There's something to be said for getting that money if it's you know, just, and then using it and effectively to help kids not smoke. The other thing about this is that there, Senator Ginny Lyons, who has been a real advocate for smoking control over the years, plans to introduce a bill to ban menthol cigarettes.
Yeah, now that actually runs counter to the policy that was just announced by the Trump administration, right?
I have no idea.
Because they were talking about.
I don't know what the administration's up to, but the fact that there is a on the table, there is a ban of at least one kind of cigarettes, and that is a.
Oh, you mean right? Oh, you mean traditional tobacco cigarettes, the menthol.
Yes.
That's right. Ginny Lyons did mention when she was on a show a couple weeks ago, and she mentioned that that was a possible piece of legislation from her.
And that's like, you know, 5%, I think, of the market is menthol cigarettes. So it's not an insignificant piece. So anyway, just a good conversation, and Happy New Year to both of you guys, too.
All right. Hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it, Guy. We'll talk to you soon. Hey, so Josh, what is your sense here? I mean, do you feel like there are any school districts that might turn the other way and say, no, we're not going to join this thing?
I can't imagine. I mean, there's no cost to them, so there's no immediate downside that I can think of. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever the lawsuit is they're going to be working on contingency. So I think as long as there isn't some initial cash output, I don't see any real downside to go ahead and joining it. And, it, you know, especially as you look around, like, the districts that have, you know, Burlington, Rutland, Barry, you know, a lot of the Colchester, Essex, Champlain Valley, you know, these are the real big school districts in the state, and I can imagine that if they lead, that others will follow. I expect.
Yeah, that is it does seem to be a thing right now. So we'll see how that all unfolds as we say often as we're reporting news events, doing that kind of thing over time here on the Dave Graham Show and WDEV FM. My guest has been Josh O'Gorman. He's a reporter for the Stowe Reporter, and he is also has done some work for the Waterbury Record and elsewhere in Vermont. Solid journalist here in the state. Really appreciate you stopping by here this morning, Josh.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dave.
Alrighty, we're going to take a brief break here for the Bob of the Hour CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors when we return. I'm going to be joined by a reporter for Axios, national online publication. We're going to talk about this sudden turnaround by John Bolton yesterday. Stay with us, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can't stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, continuing into our second half hour, and I'm glad to say we've been trying for a little bit of time now to line up a new source of national commentary and news reporting here on the Dave Graham Show, we've been talking with Axios, a really excellent online news service, axios.com. They do a lot of really interesting coverage out of Washington and also on very individual and discrete topics in energy and other fields out there in the world, and it's usually nice and tersely written stuff. They have a great style of presenting their material and getting you on your way. A lot of information in a short amount of time, I guess, is one way I'd describe it. And so I like Axios myself, and I'm very happy to say that their White House reporter has agreed to get on the air with us a little bit this morning. And I have with me, tell me if I'm pronouncing your name right, is it Elena Treen?
Got it right.
All right. Thanks so much for joining me this morning, Elena. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, the big news yesterday out of Washington was John Bolton's surprise announcement that, yes, I'm willing to come and testify to the Senate. And what are you hearing? What's the reaction down there? What are folks at the White House saying?
So a lot of folks in the White House were blindsided by this. They were not given a heads up to that this was coming, although Bolton did leave a message with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell before issuing this. But the perpetual talk of whether the president's former national security advisor, John Bolton, will actually testify before Congress has a lot of people within the Trump administration and within the White House pretty terrified of that likely outcome. And that's because Bolton was a voracious note taker and he didn't leave on the best terms when he departed. And so a lot of people think that he seems like he has a lot to dish, and he does have, again, those copious notes that he took. He'd sit in some of these high-level meetings, meetings that include firsthand knowledge and conversations with the president and his discussions about Ukraine aid. And he'd sit and he'd take all these notes on his on a legal pad. And so he has a ton of information still that he could share. And so his statement yesterday that he was prepared to come forward and testify if the Senate does in fact subpoena him caught a lot of people by surprise and of course turned a lot of heads. And reporters are scrambling on the Hill yesterday trying to grab senators to see if this is actually a likely outcome.
Yeah, I mean, and do you think in terms of what you're hearing on the Hill and whether, I mean, will this actually happen, I guess, at the bottom line? You know, Mitch McConnell has been resisting the idea of bringing in any witnesses, and now here's one who's saying, basically raising his hand and saying, if you want me to, I'll come and be a witness.
Right, and that was a huge question coming into this week. So, again, with this, with the impeachment process, it's a lot of questions are still floating around about what a Senate trial would look like, and the key thing here is whether new witnesses like someone like John Bolton would come forward. I was on the Hill yesterday. I spoke with a ton of key Republican senators about this. And these are people like Senator Lisa Murkowski and Senator Susan Collins, people who are more moderate and have bucked the president and McConnell in the past, or also some people who are up for competitive reelection fights in the fall, or people who are retiring and might feel more free to speak against the president. But really, almost all of them, at least from those that I spoke with in these key states, would not be committal to saying that they would vote for a subpoena to bring Bolton in. The only one who was the most forthright was Senator Mitt Romney, but even he would not commit to voting in favor of a subpoena. And so I found that very interesting and very telling that these senators, you know, there has to be four if it comes down to a vote where 51 senators vote on what this process will look like. Democrats need four of them to vote in line with them, and it doesn't seem as of now that they have that.
Yeah, and now, meanwhile, this is another interesting wrinkle here, which is that the House has not sent its articles of impeachment over to the Senate, leaving, it seems, you know, some aspects of this case anyway open on that side of the Capitol Hill. And the House has actually talked about bringing in more witnesses and perhaps even crafting additional articles of impeachment. Is there any chance that the House will then basically, you know, Nancy Pelosi and her team will say, hey, wait a minute, if Bolton is willing to testify, let's have him over here.
Right. That's another huge question, and it's still unknown. I asked Congressman Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who's been really leading Democrats in the House, their impeachment fight. And he said yesterday, I asked him, you know, would you issue a subpoena for John Bolton if the Senate does not do so? And he would not give a clear answer. He said that he's not going to foreclose anything at this time, but that he thinks that the Senate should do this and kind of put the onus on the Senate to subpoena him. Of course, Senate is controlled majority Republican, and so it seems less likely. But I wouldn't rule it out. I think that right now, Congressman Adam Schiff has been very open about, as he mentioned, you know, potentially more articles. They've held on to the articles in order to get more information, more damning information on the president and his actions toward Ukraine, and they feel vindicated in having waited over the holiday break before sending the articles. So there's still a lot of questions that I, myself included, will be on the Hill this week trying to figure out, what is Nancy Pelosi going to do with this? Will the House try to subpoena Bolton? As of now, they are not giving any clear answer on that.
Boy, and I guess neither is Bolton in terms of, and this is interesting to me because he's saying, you know, he waits until the ball is at least in some ways in the Senate's court. Of course, the articles haven't been sent over yet, as we just talked about. But the, you know, he said yesterday, if I'm subpoenaed, I'll go testify in front of the Senate. And his office was asked, I saw in one report last night that, well, does that mean you would go and testify if called by the House? And they got no answer to that question. Are you hearing anything about that? And I have a follow up on that one. Once you tell me what's being said on, you know, is there any chance that Bolton is willing to testify in front of the House as well as the Senate?
I think you totally, you know, nailed it on the head there with, you know, the reason, the timing of this, the fact that Ambassador Bolton is coming forward now when it will be headed to the, again, Republican-controlled Senate, I think is very significant. And I personally reached out as well to Bolton's team and his spokesperson and asked, would he comply with a House subpoena if they went forward and did that? And they would not offer a comment. So I think the fact that they are not answering on that does appear to make it seem that we're going to let this be a Senate thing, focusing on whether the Senate does this.
Yeah, although I want to wonder for a moment with you what legal leg he would have to stand on, because if he's saying, I mean, it seems to me that if you say, okay, I'm eligible to testify, I'm declaring myself willing to testify, that you have a tougher time, say in court, telling a judge that, hey, judge, I'm willing to testify in this forum, but not that forum, if you see what I mean. So if the House were to call him, doesn't his willingness to testify in the Senate weaken any resistance he might have to going in front of the House?
Absolutely. And I do think that if the House did move forward and subpoena him, there would likely be, like you said, something similar would have to play out. One question that, regardless of whether it is the House or the Senate that would potentially issue a subpoena for Bolton, is the White House could always come back and try to assert executive privilege, as they have done on numerous occasions in the past when the House had subpoenaed key witnesses in the impeachment inquiry. The only difference there, of course, is that Bolton is a former official, but he's the former national security advisor. A lot of what he could potentially share would be subject to national security information, some of which might be classified. And so it wouldn't be surprising that if a subpoena does, whether from either chamber, move forward trying to compel his testimony, it could end up in the court again, just like it did with Charles Kupperman's case. He was a deputy national security advisor who had gone to the court with legal action when he was subpoenaed. And so, again, a ton of questions here. It really comes down to whether, one, either the Senate or the House will actually issue a subpoena, and two, whether this ends up going to the courts because of the White House's attempt to block his testimony.
Okay, now I have to tell you about the crazy Twitter and Facebook feeds I seem to have landed in just over time. And one of the things I saw floating around this morning out in social media land was a few memes talking about, and I remember the words, it's a trap, as in Bolton was going to come in and the Democrats basically should shy away because Bolton was going to come in and actually defend the president. Now, meanwhile, one of the early sort of headlines out of this whole story with Bolton was his alleged comment during while the White House was deliberating and what to do about Ukraine and so on, that it was a drug deal, that this thing the president and his people were trying to work out, he described it as a drug deal, which actually says to me he had a pretty dim view of the thing. And so, is there any chance that Bolton's going to come into the Senate, let's say, and say, I think everything the president did was just fine and defend him?
No one knows what he could potentially say, but all indications lead to no, he will not be saying that he thinks that the president acted 100%, in good faith. It does. A lot of officials who were in the room with Bolton, who have shared conversations with Bolton about this aid and the hold on it, made it very clear that Ambassador Bolton was not happy with the way that this was happening. He had urged a lot of key officials to go to Secretary Mike Pompeo, go to the Office of Management and Budget, and really probe them on why is this hold being held up. And he seemed to have a negative view of Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, having, being very involved in this entire process and the diplomacy toward Ukraine. And so all indications from those who have spoken directly with John Bolton about this show that if he does come in and testify, he doesn't expect to have a positive view of how this has played out.
Yeah, boy, I mean, either that or it would be such a huge change from everything we've read and heard so far. It would be, will the real John Bolton please stand up or something? Anyway, well, listen, Elena Treen, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. I think I've kept you longer than I promised you, and I really thank you for being a voice on the Dave Graham Show here in WDEV. Hope to do so again.
Yes, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Alrighty, we'll talk soon. So long. All right, we are heading to the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show, WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay tuned. In the second hour, we're going to focus on the Brattleboro Retreat. Some interesting conversations coming up. CBS News coming up at you right now.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
My next guest is Sarah Squirrel. She is the Commissioner of Mental Health for the state of Vermont, and she is in the thick of a discussion, I guess it would be one way to put it, with the Brattleboro Retreat. And the Brattleboro Retreat, of course, is a privately run psychiatric hospital down in Brattleboro, which contracts with the state and has been a linchpin of the state's mental health system really since the Waterbury State Hospital closed after being flooded by Tropical Storm Irene in 2011. And the retreat also has been on a bit of a bumpy road financially in recent years, so they tell us, and so others tell us about them. And I'm very happy to bring in, and by the way, I should say the news is on the Brattleboro retreat is over the weekend, it was announced that they had told the state that if they didn't get a sudden infusion of cash from the state of Vermont, $2 million was the latest ask, they were going to be needing to close the facility or sell the facility, some kind of a big upheaval there. And response from the state's Human Services Secretary, Mike Smith, who, by the way, as you know, is a former host of this very program. Mike responded very skeptically to that and basically said, we have been working out special financial arrangements with the retreat for some time, and we think this is just going a bit too far. So we're gonna get into some of the details. But first, I wanted to introduce my next guest, who is Sarah Squirrel. She's the Commissioner of Mental Health of the state of Vermont. Thanks so much for coming in, Commissioner.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And tell me a little bit about some of the history here. I mean, I tried to recap it very briefly, but the Brattleboro Retreat, how would you describe their role in the state's mental health system in the last 8 or 9 years?
Yeah, the Brattleboro Retreat has a significant role and capacity in the mental health system of care, and is also a significant employer in the Brattleboro area. So in terms of the overall capacity that they provide about 50% of our adult inpatient capacity to the mental health system of care, as well as 100% of our child and youth inpatient capacity, in addition to additional residential programs, outpatient programs, and substance use programs. They provide treatment, care, and services to about 2,500 Vermonters annually.
That's a big footprint.
Yes.
In a small state's mental health system. Refresh me on how many beds do they have for adult inpatient care these days?
Right now, they have capacity for 89.
89. And I think of the old number used to be in connection with Waterbury State Hospital here was, I think, around 50 or 52 was the capacity there. So we're really talking about something which is significantly larger than Waterbury in terms of how big a role it plays, right?
Yeah. And one thing also to keep in mind, the Vermont State Hospital was the highest acuity in the state of Vermont. There was other inpatient capacity across the state. So our overall level one capacity, which would what would equate to Vermont State Hospital level of care, we had 54 beds at the Brattleboro the old State Hospital. Mm-hmm. We currently have 25 level one beds at VPCH, 14 level one beds at the Brattleboro Retreat, and 6 level one beds at Rutland Regional Medical Center.
Okay, so that's a key distinction. I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, just the big raw numbers made me think, wow, this is bigger than maybe. But when you describe the level one beds, I mean, we got to go apples to apples here, I guess is what you're saying.
Exactly. And we also have other inpatient capacity in our other designated hospitals across the state. That includes the UVM Medical Center, Central Vermont Medical Center, the Wyndham Center, the VA, et cetera.
And so would some of those be, is it called level two, or is there a next level down, or how does that work?
There's varying levels, how different hospitals identify it. Level one was codified by the legislature post-Hurricane Irene. Mm-hmm. We tend to refer to that other capacity as inpatient psychiatric capacity in the system of care.
Okay. And so, but if the Brattleboro Retreat went away, which is, I mean, that was the headline, is it could close or be sold. I guess selling it to somebody else would probably want to keep it open in some fashion. But if it were to suddenly be removed from the state's overall mental health system, what would that look like?
Yes, any precipitous closing of the Brattleboro Retreat would have a significant impact and put pressure on the mental health system of care, and of course would have an adverse economic impact on the Brattleboro area. So because of that impact that we understand, and when we received the letter from the retreat indicating that they were planning for sale or closure, we took that very, very seriously. The safety and well-being of Vermonters who are receiving inpatient and residential treatment, care, and support at the Brattleboro Retreat is the top priority of the Agency of Human Services. It's the top priority of the administration. So we certainly did our due diligence to start thinking about contingency planning and what would that look like. We were very encouraged and have continued to be encouraged to hear the CEO indicate in recent interviews that they are not planning to sell or close the retreat. And certainly it's in the best interest of Vermonters, the Agency of Human Services, and the administration feel like, you know, we really want to find a path forward.
Do you think there's any element here of, you know, the legislature is just coming into the session this week. The appropriations committees are going to be starting to meet in earnest and also meet in Montpelier. No, that's a bad joke there. And I mean, is there any element here of a shakedown, basically? I mean, is this holding the gun to the head of the legislature and saying, hey, we want more money? And by the way, here's how drastic the whole scene is when we talk about closure or selling or whatever.
Yes, and I'm sure that the board of directors at the Brattleboro Retreat leadership took the letter that they delivered to the Agency of Human Services as seriously as we did. Mm-hmm. We are certainly in a position of needing to respond to ensure that should there be an imminent or precipitous closing of the retreat, that we are well prepared.
So you're not, I sort of understand why you're not going to bite, but I hope you understand why I have to ask whether there's an element here of, this does feel like, again, given the timing right at the start of the legislative session, there are an awful lot of people who show up in Montpelier this time of year with budget requests. And, you know, I guess if you have a really loud and emphatic one, maybe that helps loosen up some more money. I don't know, but it just does seem. And I'll obviously, we're going to have Lewis Josephson, the CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat, on in the last half hour of the program this morning. I'll put the question to him as well. I mean, is there any, because I mean, the other thing that I think the public needs to know here, and Mike Smith was making this point quite emphatically in the statement he released over the weekend about his response to the retreat, where he said he rejected this latest request for $2 million. And essentially then went through the list of recent asks from the retreat and positive responses from the state. Yes, we will give you more money. Talk to us about a couple of those. What are the highlights? I mean, this is not the first time the retreat has come calling.
Yeah, that's accurate. I think they've had a history of needing financial relief and support from the state of Vermont. They do serve, I think, 70% of their revenue does come from Medicaid patients. And this is why the Agency of Human Services and Secretary Smith have worked so hard and in such good faith with the retreat over the past several months, taking their fiscal need very, very seriously. And we put together a slate of fiscal investments in the retreat to help them achieve fiscal stability. That included looking at rate increases, additional rate increases, in addition to rate increases that they received in 2018. Those rate increases applied to their CRT inpatient beds, their overall inpatient beds. There were retroactive rate increases to the total of $2.7 million, and also ongoing rate increases that would be reflected in the FY21 budget in the amount of $2.5 million. Also, the state has invested $5.5 million in capital funds to support the construction of 12 new level one beds. And also, the FY21 budget includes funding for the operation of those beds. So that totals, as Secretary Smith outlined in his letter, about $16 million in fiscal investment rate increases to the Brattleboro retreat. So again, working in good faith with the organization, recognizing their significance as a mental health provider, recognizing their significance as an employer in the region. And I think at this point, as I mentioned, we are happy to hear that they are not planning sale or closure. We think that and hope we will work with them to find a path forward. But also really recognizing that we have to address the continued fiscal instability of the retreat despite the significant efforts and fiscal investments that the state has made to support them.
So, I mean, it sounds like at one level that you and Secretary Smith are worried or sympathetic about I don't know if you'd call it the plight of the retreat, but sort of they do have issues down there trying to keep up with, especially rising labor costs, I guess, are a huge factor in anybody trying to deliver human services like this. And and yet there's also a lot of concern about is the retreat doing a really good job keeping its books? And so how do you balance those two?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what you've seen the Agency of Human Services do over the past few months, and why we want to ensure that, you know, with these additional investments to the retreat, how do we look at, you know, management operational practices that are also impacting the retreat. As someone who's run community mental health programs, certainly understanding that how we're reimbursed as a community provider is just one part of the equation. How we actually manage our fiscal operations, how we manage our admissions, how we manage our operations is the responsibility of the provider. So I think that is why, you know, we have some concern and really want to spend some time thinking strategically about the retreat as we go forward. We do want to be good stewards of state taxpayer dollars and want to ensure that there really is a long-term viable path for the Brattleboro retreat so that they can continue to provide the essential care and treatment that they do and that we have a path for fiscal stability.
Well, speaking of fiscal stability, it's kind of interesting to me because I actually was a longtime reporter for the Associated Press based in Montpelier, and my last year there was 2016. And in August of that year, I wrote a story which started by saying the Vermont Attorney General's Office is conducting a criminal investigation into the Brattleboro retreat following a whistleblower's complaints about alleged Medicaid fraud at the private psychiatric hospital. Attorney General William Sorrell acknowledged that his office was investigating, and his comments, coupled with documents provided to the AP in response to public records requests, show the probe has gone beyond the concerns first aired by a former hospital employee, Thomas Joseph. And Sorrell said that the investigation we are conducting is not narrow in scope. Now, I have a question that's somewhat personally embarrassing to me to ask, because I left the AP at the end of 2016, just a couple months after this story ran, and I sort of lost track of it. Whatever happened with that investigation? Did that ever produce any results, or Where are we on that? Do you know?
I would have to follow up with folks back at the Agency of Human Services. I'm not sure of the exact outcome of that investigation.
Okay. The only reason I bring it up, too, is, I mean, number one, I think it's legit because it was a publicly published story and widely acknowledged at the time. But it also, I think, points to the idea that these questions about the fiscal management and so on at the Brattleboro Retreat have been going on for a while. This is not a new set of questions for how well is the retreat keeping its books? Are they really making sure that they are dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's and that sort of thing down there? Do you have any general sense of your own confidence on that overall question? Do you feel like it's a well-run place financially, or are there real problems?
Well, what I do know is that they've, I think, had some challenges retaining a chief fiscal officer. Mm-hmm. I believe their previous chief fiscal officer resigned. I know they had hired someone newly into that position and may have some just gaps in terms of leadership in their org chart there. Part of the process that the Agency of Human Services went through when we were working in good faith with the retreat over the summer was really to go in and look at their books. Essentially, we weren't going in to determine, are they operating, kind of evaluating how they're operating fiscally. Mm-hmm. It was more to verify the information that they were giving us, that we were utilizing to then calculate what rate increases make sense, what had rationale. So they're their own private organization with their own board of directors, their own leadership, and I think the burden of responsibility on their fiscal operations rests with their organization and their board of directors.
In an ideal world, is that the best model? I mean, we've now tried the Waterbury State Hospital, obviously very much a public facility owned and operated by the state of Vermont for all those years, decades. And now we are in a situation where, the largest linchpin of our mental health system is this private nonprofit in Brattleboro. Which is the better way to go if you were, teaching a political science class on public versus private in the mental health field? What would you say?
Yes, well, Vermont has a long history of a diverse array of public and private partners providing human services across the state. Most of the services provided for mental health are done through partnerships. Our network of designated community mental health agencies, the designated hospitals, and then also having a mix of state-run and facilitated facilities, such as VPCH, mm-hmm. The Middlesex Therapeutic Community Residence. I think what's in the best interest of Vermonters and from an economic and service delivery standpoint is to have a strong network of community partners that are providing these services, working in collaboration with the state of Vermont. I think the question or the opportunity that we might have right now as a state, as we think about the future of the Brattleboro Retreat, is kind of evaluating what is the socially and fiscally optimal scale and scope of that organization, and what can we realistically sustain from a fiscal standpoint as a state. And do we want to be thinking more long-term about diversifying some of that capacity across the rest of the state of Vermont? Also to note that the Brattleboro Retreat is the largest freestanding psychiatric facility in the state of Vermont. Nationally, the conversation is about integration of mental health care within the broader healthcare system. So as a much longer term frame, we should be thinking about opportunities to move our system of care in that direction. How do we integrate mental health care more broadly into the healthcare system? Those are not decisions that we want to be making overnight. Those are long-term decisions or considerations and opportunities for the state that I think we have an opportunity to really reflect on right now.
So as we go forward, I mean, sort of try to crystal ball it out 2030, 10 years from now, Do you think that the footprint of the Brown River Retreat in the mental health system in Vermont will be smaller?
It may look different. It may. I think this is one of the opportunity areas that we would like to engage with the Brattleboro Retreat around, really thinking strategically about the future needs of Vermonters, not just the here and now, but looking out 2030. Are there opportunities to think about different capacity, different areas in our system of care that we have need? I do know that Dr. Josephson has articulated interest in having those conversations. So I think, I don't know exactly what that would look like, but I think there's an opportunity right now that could really help continue to advance the system forward.
You know, it's fascinating to me, this whole business of the mental health field, because when I started as a reporter back in the late 1970s, I was down in Western Massachusetts. I worked for the paper in Springfield, and there was a huge old state hospital in Northampton, which was going through, had actually closed just a couple of years before I first got there. And it was the buzzword, which I always hated. I couldn't stand typing it as a journalist, but because we like short words, but it was deinstitutionalization, which basically meant moving people out of these big old brick state psychiatric hospitals into smaller facilities, get them out into the community to the extent possible, and at the same time, we've had an explosion of the ability to treat people with pharmaceuticals, with drugs, and to try to manage mental health issues that way. So people are able with the proper medications to maintain their life balance and so on. Has that been a good thing overall in the last 40 years, would you say?
Oh, yes. I think that that is a movement in the right direction. And Vermont has been a great leader, and it's a great story to tell for Vermont. We have an incredibly strong network of community mental health providers. When you look at Vermont's data related to our utilization of community-based level of care versus state hospital level of care nationally, we are far above the averages when it comes to the utilization of our community-based care and below when it comes to our utilization of hospital care. Mm-hmm. And I think we also have to keep in mind that we will always need a strong continuum of care. Promotion, prevention, early intervention, treatment, and recovery. It's essential that we have enough and adequate inpatient capacity for those who might need that level of care. We don't want people waiting in emergency departments, long periods of time waiting for care. And we also need a robust community mental health system that can provide services on the ground that can meet the needs of individuals in the community so that they don't need that higher level of care. I'd also like to add that we have a significant network of peer providers in the organization or across the state of Vermont that is also an essential part of our capacity.
And let me ask you also, in terms of just the sort of institutional shift here, you mentioned that there's been a push on for greater integration of mental health into the hospitals, basically community health and et cetera. And I'm wondering, sometimes I sense there's some friction there. Now, obviously, the anecdotes about people stuck in emergency rooms for days on end in mental health crisis. I've been in ERs before for medical stuff, and there's somebody in the couple beds down the hall or something who is really, frankly, causing a lot of trouble for the staff of this community hospital. And so it's not always easy, for sure. I mean, I think you would acknowledge that. How's that going? Are the community hospitals up to and including the UVM Medical Center welcoming and accepting of this population, or has it been a kind of a tough transition?
Our hospital partners who have emergency departments have been incredible partners with the state of Vermont. They are the first point of access for many individuals who are seeking psychiatric care. They work very closely with the Department of Mental Health. I have a care management team that is essentially triaging anyone who is under the care and custody of the commissioner who is waiting in an ED to get them into appropriate inpatient care. And overall, our system of emergency departments, the emergency department directors have been great partners. Are they under pressure? Do we have tension points sometime? of course. But overall, we are all pulling in the same direction to ensure that we're meeting the needs of those who are needing inpatient care.
Do we need any new facilities like the Vermont Psychiatric Care Hospital that currently in Berlin? I mean, any more beds of that type under state ownership?
Well, one of the other factors is that we do have the 12 new level one beds that are under construction at the Brattleboro Retreat. Other capacity in the system of care, it's also essential that we have adequate step down capacity. So once you're ready to leave inpatient level of care, it's really important in order to achieve flow in the system that we can move you in a timely way through the system. If we don't have adequate step-down capacity, residential level of care, then that's where we see people waiting in hospitals, which then puts pressure on the EDs. So we're very excited to also be moving forward with the 16-bed physically secure residential facility, which essentially provides step-down capacity for those individuals who are stepping down from level one beds.
Okay, so Brattleboro Retreat comes to the state of Vermont and says, we need another $2 million, please. And by the way, let me back this up. Are they too big to fail right now? And is that part of the issue here?
They have an enormous amount of capacity in the state of Vermont and are an essential partner. In terms of their child and youth capacity, holding 100% of that capacity when we are faced with a situation where there is the thinking about an imminent closure, that puts us in a very vulnerable position as a state.
Yeah.
So I would say that as we move forward, we do need to be thinking about where we have a diversity of capacity across the state so that we are not 100% reliant on one facility to provide that level of care. So I think that's something we will need to be thinking about, particularly as it relates to child and youth inpatient capacity in the state of Vermont.
Is this little give and take here, or big give and take, I guess, maybe? Has it been kind of a wake-up call on that score that, you know, we really need to diversify where we're going to put people in case one of our facilities suddenly had to close?
When you are sitting in my shoes and working on contingency planning, yes, it becomes very real and very clear about what our limitations are as a system of care. We have had some conversations with CVPH, which is an inpatient child and youth hospital that's just across the lake, about opportunities for them to place voluntary children if needed.
Wow. Lots of moving parts here. Sarah Squirrel is the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Mental Health. Thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Really
good talking with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We're going to take a brief break for some bottom of the hour news here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay with us. We'll be hearing from somebody from the Brattleboro Retreat and I believe from State Senator Jeanette White in the next half hour segment. We'll be back, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back for our last half hour of today's program on this Tuesday morning, January the 7th, 2020. And the legislature is just starting up this morning over in Montpelier, and we're going to be visiting with some of the folks there on Friday upcoming, the 10th of January will be our first Friday morning. This is a tradition on the Dave Graham Show, formerly the open mic with now Human Services Secretary Mike Smith, and before that, the Mark Johnson Show. Long tradition here at WDEV of having the host of this program decamp to the State House on Friday mornings during the legislative session, and I'm very glad to be continuing that. It's always a nice time to go over there and see folks and talk to them about what the big issues are of that particular week in the legislative session, and be glad to be doing that this coming Friday morning. So don't miss that show, folks, if you're able to tune in between 9 and 11. Of course, any weekday morning, 9 to 11 is when we're on the air. Don't forget about our podcast. If you can't listen when we're live, you can always go to WDEVradio.com. It's a good place to live stream us, too, in case you're not near the old terrestrial radio situation, but you got some internet access. WDEVradio.com offers up a live stream of whatever the station is doing at that time. So right now, on the internet, we're offering this program, and but we've also got this podcast where you can listen. You can scroll. You can actually go from the WDEVradio.com homepage to the Dave Graham Show. Just follow the link from the homepage to the show. Scroll down a bit. You'll find a list of our recent programs by topic and guest, and be able to pick and choose the stuff you want to hear. So that's always a good thing. By the way, we want to thank the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store, for its sponsorship of our podcast. All right. Well, I wanted to spend another chunk of time here on the Brattleboro Retreat situation, and I'm very glad to say I've got a couple of good guests coming up. We just had a good conversation with the Commissioner of Mental Health, Sarah Squirrel, here on the Dave Graham Show. And next up, we have Lewis Josephson. He is the CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat, the institution that's been much in the news the last couple days. And by the way, I do want to credit VPR with breaking that story over the weekend. I always like to make sure that the journalists who were first out with the story get a nod, and there you go. VPR, they're doing some good work these days, and this story was no exception. I want to mention the... I was going to say we have Lewis Josephson coming on, and also Senator Jeanette White. She's a Democrat from Windham County, which is where the Brattleboro Retreat is. Very important employer down there, and just general participant in the local scene, the local economy of Windham County. And so it's a big institution and concern to anybody who would represent that part of the state in the legislature, and Senator White's no exception. So I want to welcome my guests. Mr. Josephson, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks. Good morning.
And Senator White, so glad to have you with us.
Thanks, Dave.
And so, Lewis Josephson, I want to start with you and get your sense of what your reaction was to Mike Smith's reaction, the Human Services Secretary, who said basically no way, no how, and you said we need another $2 million.
A couple of things. You know, I get it. We're a small state. We don't have a lot of money, and I'm a Vermont taxpayer. I don't want to pay any money that I don't have to. I get it. And I know that the Agency of Human Services is under a lot of stress. There's a lot of providers who need support to provide care to Vermonters. So we're very aware of that. In fact, we did not ask for $2 million. We've been in negotiations with Human Services for a couple of years now about our financial situation, have worked through different situations with them. So this was really a continuation of a discussion, and we just wanted the secretary to know where we were and what the issues were. And we also don't come asking for bailouts. We come with ideas that are win-wins for Vermont and the retreat. We've made some substantial reductions in costs in 2019 and expenses, and we're planning to do the same in 2020. So we're trying to be good partners, and I certainly understand that the secretary is under a lot of pressure. I feel bad for the guy. I know he's got a lot on his plate right now.
Well, so when he says in his statement that he issued over the weekend, last week the retreat came back asking for an additional $2 million, that doesn't really present an accurate picture?
Well, we didn't ask for a dollar figure. I'm not sure that I didn't hear something correctly at the meeting. What we did was we had recently got an increase in our Medicaid rate, 11.1%. When we did that, we said thank you, and we're not sure that's going to hold us, and in fact, it didn't. So we came back last week and just showed transparently what our cash position is, where we're headed in terms of revenues and expense, but we didn't put a dollar figure that I recall on the table. We just wanted him to be aware of what we were and the potential impact on services.
And the Brattleboro Retreat has a big role in the state's mental health system, as I'm sure you are aware. And I was just talking about that really the last 20 minutes or so with Commissioner Squirrel of the Department of Mental Health. And it sounds like she thinks in an ideal world that it wouldn't be as dominant a player in the state's mental health system as it is currently. What's your sense of that?
Well, it's true. Right now, we are over 50% of all the inpatient psychiatric beds in the state. We have 30, the only child and adolescent inpatient beds. We have 14 of the level one, what are sometimes referred to as state hospital beds here. And what I would say to that, and I've said this to the secretary, I've said this to the governor, we've been here 185 years. We're a great institution, but as CEO, I don't have any skin in the game that we continue to exist exactly as we are. I'm open to change. If we can serve more people in the community, that's better for people with mental illness. I'm happy to do that. So I'm very open to transforming the retreat to be nimbler, different. My only point to the state leadership is that to do that safely, we need some time and space to make that happen. You just can't flip a switch and do that quickly. But I'd say let's engage in the next 6 months, year, whatever the right time frame. And if the Commissioner of Mental Health has a different vision for services in the state, we will be there. And if it means we shrink and transform, we will do that.
So you basically, it sounds like your goal here is to respond to what the customer wants, the customer being the state of Vermont or the public in general.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm a Vermont taxpayer, and if we can serve people better, cheaper in the community, and live their lives more in the community and not in the hospital, that's a win-win for me as a taxpayer and for the state. But we've got to have a transition period from where we are now to that new future state. And it's going to take a little time, and it's going to take some bridge funding to get us to that point. Because if we just let a retreat go away at 50% of the beds in the state, that's going to be terrible for our patients. I cannot accept that as a mental health practitioner. We've got to be able to be here and safely care for people that the state has asked us to care for all these years. We're not doing anything that the state hasn't asked us on a daily basis, asked us to do. We're just saying we need to be paid fairly to get that done so we can serve them tomorrow.
So when the retreat was saying last week that, you know, we're going to have to sell the place or close, and now, you know, we just had, I don't know if you heard the interview with Commissioner Squirrel here, but she was saying that, you know, now we're hearing that that's not really the case, that the retreat is not on the brink of doing either of those things. I want to get the answer basically to the same question from the CEO, Mr. Josephson, Lewis Josephson. You've been CEO of the retreat for now how long? For
4 years.
4 years, okay. And you are obviously in a position to know. So is the retreat on the brink of needing to be sold or closed?
Well, let me give you the answer straight up. It is, we're in a serious position here. We and our Board of Trustees felt we needed to let state government know that we're in a serious position. And they did instruct me to explore what it would mean if we were to close the retreat for our patients and our mission and our trust, and what the possibilities for sale. And the thought about sale is that if we can't afford to continue to provide services, could some other entity come in and at least try to keep some services going for Vermonters. So that was really the goal. These are last-ditch, sort of worst-case nightmare scenarios. We're working super hard not to have that be the case. We're working on plans right now at the retreat to say if the state could not give us another penny beyond what they give us right now, how could we right-size our operation to continue to serve at least some Vermonters in the future without more support. But I will tell you, you know, with my business hat on, when you're operating with so little cash in the bank, it's scary, and it is fair and mature and appropriate for the board to say, we are so close to the edge that it doesn't take much to tip you over into a crisis of closure. And so I think they were just trying to be responsible fiduciaries of the organization and let the state not be surprised that we're in a really tough spot and something could go sideways. And so we weren't saying that as a threat or a negotiating tactic or anything like that, but just a fact. When you have so little cash in the bank, as you know, as a business, it's scary, and it's often things don't go as you plan. If there's no backup, you're right up against closure.
How many employees do you have there at the retreat?
We have about 840 employees, and that's about 635 full-time equivalents. We have about 550 unionized employees. And, you know, we did some really, I think, progressive things for them in our last labor contract. We brought our mental health workers, who are kind of like the foundation of our staff, 250 of them, all brought up to a minimum of $15 an hour. We're very proud of that. They do hard work. They do great work. So,
are you the largest employer in Windham County?
We are, absolutely.
That's what I thought I understood. Let me bring in, speaking of Windham County, let me bring in the state senator who represents that jurisdiction in southeastern Vermont. Jeanette White is also on the line with us. Senator White, let me ask you, when you hear about the possible closure of an employer which has 840 employees, 600 and something FTE, that's got to make you lose some sleep, right?
Yes, that does. And I have to say that I'll start with that, but I want to say more about the patients. But if there were a business that made widgets in Windham County that had 800 employees and mm-hmm. they said they were going to close, the state would be down there on bended knee saying, what can we do for you? We'll do anything we can. We'll give you money. We'll give you training. We'll give you... They would do anything they could to keep those 800 employees there. So,
well, I can think of one exception to that rule. The last time an employer of similar size said it was closing, some folks in the state were like, yeah, we've been pushing for that for years.
Yes.
That would be, of course, the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. But
that is true. But they actually then had a plan, and they closed over a period of time.
Yeah,
and they, So that is true. But, okay, if this was in Chittenden County, would... Okay, so
I don't mean to needle you, Senator. I just thought it was—it's kind of ironic when I think, and it's too bad for obviously for the folks affected that these two large employers, the one's gone and the other one is as the CEO just said, on the edge.
So I do want to correct something you said, though, that it was an impact to the local area, and mm-hmm. it is an impact to the entire state in terms of the mental health patients. And Dr. Josephson said it very well. And I will credit the retreat. They've kept the delegation aware of what's going on and where they are and how close they are to needing additional help. And I'm not going to get into too much detail here, but there is some additional help that should have happened a long time ago. That should, I won't go into detail, but I think that it is actually owed to the retreat, and I'll leave that for a more detailed discussion. But it is important to our whole mental health system. And there are thousands of people from around the state. There are many outpatients. It's the hub of our hub and spoke system. And the states around the country are looking at our hub and spoke system and saying, that's a real way to deal with the opioid issue. Well, if we don't have the hub, we don't have the spoke. So that's an issue. They also provide specialized training. I don't know if you know it or not, but they have a really wonderful program for uniformed employees. That's firemen, cops, military people, and people from all over the country use that program. It's well respected.
Hmm.
I just want to say something about the retreat. In its reimbursement, gets approximately $1,000 a day less per patient than the state hospital in Berlin. That amount, if you took those 14 patients, that amounts to about $5 million a year. But they're getting less than the Berlin hospital. So that's an issue that we have to deal with. And that's been years of reimbursement. That isn't just something that just happened now, but it exacerbates the program. And I just want to say that I am just appalled that Dr. Josephson was very generous to the secretary. I don't think I'm going to be very generous to the secretary. He knows nothing about mental health, and for him to come in and say, we can just replace it, we can do it, is just nonsense. It's ridiculous. I'm a little bit heated up here, as you can probably tell. And over the years, the retreat and the state have partnered very well. And you could see that in Irene, and you could see it in the new state hospital that's there, the 14 beds. They're looking at more beds now at the retreat. So there's been a real good partnership. Now it seems like we've developed an adversarial
relationship. When Algo Bay was there, it was a partnership. Now it looks like we have an adversarial relationship, and I find it very upsetting. And I think that we have the right creative people and the right board at the retreat to look at how we partner with the state and how we move forward to serve the mental health needs of the state of Vermont and New England. And if the administration isn't willing to do that, they have to be willing to enter this partnership on a basis of helping to solve the problem, not of finger pointing and blame.
We have a caller on the line, Ruth from Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Yes, I've been listening with great interest. And when I heard Mike Smith say that, when he said no, I cheered and applauded. I sympathize with the problems that the mental health facility is having. But the whole state of Vermont is having that. All the people in Vermont are having the same problems. You seem to think that the answer to all problems is more money. But we don't have more money to give you. You're going to have to rearrange how you do your stuff. I had the same type of problem. All our people were on Medicaid. We had to deal with it, and we did. It can be done. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ruth. Dr. Josephson, let me get your thoughts about that. I mean, I'm sure that's a common reaction around Vermont right now, is that, you know, here comes a human services agency asking for more money. What else is new? Boy, are we getting impatient with this kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree with the caller. I totally get it, and she's not wrong whatsoever. So here's my response to that. The state of Vermont has come to us and asked us to serve a bunch of people. They can't pay us enough to serve them in a way that sustains the organization. So what we did was go back to the state and say, to serve the people you're asking us to serve, this is what it costs. And they say back to us, we don't have the money. So in the short term, it's a crisis, but we're working on, as I mentioned earlier, a plan to shrink and right-size the organization. So, for example, we have 105 people on a daily basis inpatient here at the retreat. If we're able to get to a stable position by serving 80 people, that's what we'll do. Then it's up for people like Ruth and the state to say, what happens to those other 25 people every day? What I worry about, and I just want to be transparent here, is those other 25 people, given our current mental health system, sit in emergency rooms. And they cost money for the hospitals. And the hospitals, believe me, they don't eat the cost, right? And then we turn around and say, oh, my God, the health care costs in Vermont are going up. But I totally get it. If we can serve only 80 people, we will. And the state will have to figure out how they want to serve those extra people that we used to serve here that we can't afford as Vermont to serve anymore. And she's not wrong. You know, with limited budget, you've got to make priorities. And if our services are not a priority for the state, that's understandable.
Yeah, it's a tough thing because, I mean, and folks who suffer from mental illness, you know, my work as a reporter, I worked for the Associated Press for more than 30 years here in Vermont before leaving at the end of 16 and now I'm doing this talk radio thing. You know, I noticed over time with mental health patients and sometimes with people in the correction system that you got to a situation where there was not a lot of regard for some of the people in the state's care and custody, that they were just considered, you know, nothing but burdens on society, and let's minimize what we need to deliver in those realms. I don't know, it is a hard thing, but
I do think you're touching on an issue of stigma, and though Ruth isn't wrong in her comments, I always wonder if we were talking about we couldn't serve people with cardiac issues or kidney issues or elderly people with issues, and it meant they couldn't get a hospital bed when they needed it, I don't know that we always get the same reaction. When it's people with depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder, it seems we are a little more comfortable saying, sorry, we just can't afford it.
Isn't it? I mean, I think that's really something that's worth folks thinking about because, you know, I also remember the great work of Ken Libertoff over the years. He was with the Vermont Association for Mental Health for many years, and he used to, and he pushed and he got past the legislation relating to mental health parity in treatment. And whether that goal remains illusory, I guess, is the subject for another edition of the Dave Graham Show because we are just pushing up to the top of the hour here and got to quit for the day. But hey, my guests have been Dr. Lewis Josephson. He is the CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat. I want to thank him. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
I want to thank Senator Jeanette White for joining us, giving his perspective of legislator from down in that area. Thank you, Senator.
Thanks, Dave.
And I also want to thank again Sarah Squirrel, the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Mental Health. She hasn't got an easy job either. Hey, that's about it for the Dave Graham Show. Really appreciate all you tuning in. Do so again tomorrow. We'll have more interesting conversations here on the WDEV FM and AM radio signal. And stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and our midday news service. Still to come.